Okay, that's something. What about taking those missiles out before they can launch? Ryan asked next. The Chinese silos have recently been upgraded in protection. Steel armor on the concrete covers. Shaped like a Chinese coolie hat, it will probably deflect most bombs, but not the deep penetrators, the GBU-27s we used on the railroad bridges. If they have any left over there, better ask Gus Wallace, the vice president warned. What do you mean? Brentano asked. I mean we never made all that many of them, and the Air Force must have dropped about 40 last night. I'll check that, SecDef promised. What if he doesn't? Jack asked. Then either we get some more in one big hurry, or we think up something else, Tomcat replied. Like what, Robbie? Hell, send in a special operations team and blow them the fuck up, a former fighter pilot suggested. I wouldn't much want to try that myself, Mickey Moore observed. Beats the hell out of a 5-megaton bomb going off on Capitol Hill, Mickey, Jackson shot back. Look, the preferred thing to do is find out if Gus Wallace has the right bombs. It's a long stretch for the black jets, but you can tank them going and coming, and put fighters up to protect the tankers. It's complicated, but we practice that sort of thing. If he doesn't have the goddamn bombs, we fly them to him. Assuming there are any. You know, weapon storage isn't a cornucopia, guys. There's a finite, discrete number for every item in the inventory. General Moore, Ryan said, call General Wallace and find out, right now, if you would. Yes, sir. Moore stood and left the situation room. Look, Ed Foley said, pointing to the TV. It started. The wood line erupted in a sheet of flame 2 kilometers across. The sight caused the eyes of the Chinese tankers to flare, but most of the front rank of tank crews didn't have time for much more than that. Of the 30 tanks in that line, only 3 escaped immediate destruction. It was little better for the personnel carriers interspersed with them. "You may commence firing, Colonel," Sinyovsky told his artillery commander. The command was relayed at once, and the ground shook beneath their feet. It was spectacular to see on the computer terminal. The Chinese had walked straight into the ambush, and the effect of the Russian opening volley was ghastly to behold. Major Tucker took in a deep breath as he saw several hundred men lose their lives. "Back to their artillery," Bondarenko ordered. "Yes, sir." Tucker complied at once, altering the focus of the high-altitude camera and finding the Chinese artillery. It was mainly of the towed sort, being pulled behind trucks and tractors. They were a little slow getting the word. The first Russian shells were falling around them before any effort was made to stop the trucks and lift the limbers off the towing hooks. And for all that, the Chinese gunners worked rapidly. But theirs was a race against death, and death had a head start. Tucker watched one gun crew struggle to manhandle their 122mm gun into a firing position. The gunners were loading the weapon when 3 shells landed close enough to upset the weapon and kill more than half their number. Zooming in the camera, he could see one private writhing on the ground, and there was no one close by to offer him assistance.
"It is a miserable business, isn't it?" Bondarenko observed quietly.
"Yeah," Tucker agreed. When a tank blew up, it was easy to tell yourself that a tank was just a thing. Even though you knew that 3 or 4 human beings were inside, you couldn't see them. As a fighter pilot never killed a fellow pilot, but only shot down his aircraft, so Tucker adhered to the Air Force ethos that death was something that happened to objects rather than people. Well, that poor bastard with blood on his shirt wasn't a thing, was he? He backed off the camera, taking a wider field that permitted godlike distancing from the up-close and personal aspects of the observation.
"Better that they should have remained in their own country, Major," the Russian explained to him.
"Jesus, what a mess," Ryan said. He'd seen death up-close and personal himself in his time, having shot people who had at the time been quite willing to shoot him. But that didn't make this imagery any the more palatable. Not by a long fucking shot. The president turned. Is this going out, Ed? He asked the DCI.
Ought to be, Foley replied.
And it was. On a URL, Uniform Resource Locator in NetSpeak, called http://www.darkstarfeed.cia.gov/siberiabattle/realtime.ram. It didn't even have to be advertised. Some net crawlers stumbled onto it in the first 5 minutes, and the hits from people looking at the streaming video site climbed up from 0 to 10 in a matter of 3 minutes. Then some of them must have ducked into chat rooms to spread the word. The monitoring program for the URL at CIA headquarters also kept track of the locations of the people logging into it. The first Asian country, not unexpectedly, was Japan, and the fascination of the people there in military operations guaranteed a rising number of hits. The video also included audio, the real-time comments of Air Force personnel giving some perverse color commentary back to their comrades in uniform. It was sufficiently colorful that Ryan commented on it.
"It's not meant for anyone much over the age of 30 to hear," General Moore said, coming back into the room.
"What's the story on the bombs?" Jackson asked at once.
"He's only got 2 of them," Moore replied. "The nearest others are at the factory, Lockheed Martin, Sunnyvale. They're just doing a production run right now."
"Uh-oh," Robbie observed, "back to Plan B."
"It might have to be a special operation, then, unless, Mr. President, that is, you are willing to authorize a strike with cruise missiles."
"What kind of cruise missiles?" Ryan asked, knowing the answer even so. "Well, we have 28 of them on Guam with W-80 warheads. They're little ones, only about 300 pounds. It has 2 settings, 150 or 170 kilotons."
"Thermonuclear weapons, you mean?"
General Moore let out a breath before replying.
"Yes, Mr. President."
"That's the only option we have for taking those missiles out?" He didn't have to say that he would not voluntarily launch a nuclear strike. "We could go in with conventional smart bombs, GBU-10s and 15s. Gus has enough of those, but not deep penetrators, and the protection on the silos would have a fair chance at deflecting the weapon away from the target. Now, that might not matter. The CSS-4 missiles are delicate bastards, and the impact even of a miss could scramble their guidance systems. But we couldn't be sure."
"I'd prefer that those things not fly."
"Jack, nobody wants them to fly," the Vice President said. "Mickey put together a plan. We need something to take them out. And we need it in one big fucking hurry."
"I'll call SOCOM about it, but hell, they're down in Tampa."
"Do the Russians have special operations people?" Ryan asked.
"Sure, it's called Spetsnaz.
And some of these missiles are targeted on Russia?"
"It certainly appears so, yes, sir," the chairman of the Joint Chiefs confirmed.
"Then they owe us one, and they damn well owe it to themselves," Jack said, reaching for a phone. "I need to talk to Sergei Golovko in Moscow," he told the operator.
"The American president," his secretary said.
"Ivan Nemetovich," Golovko said in hearty greeting. "The reports from Siberia are good."
"I know, Sergei. I'm watching it live now myself."
"Want to do it yourself?"
"It is possible."
"You have a computer with a modem?"
"One cannot exist without the damned things," the Russian replied.
Ryan read off the URL identifier.
"Just log onto that. We're putting the feed from our Darkstar drones onto the Internet."
"Why is that, Jack?" Golovko asked at once.
"Because as of 2 minutes ago, 1,650 Chinese citizens are watching it, and the number is going up fast."
"A political operation against them, yes? You wish to destabilize their government?"
"Well, it won't hurt our purposes if their citizens find out what's happening, will it?"
"The virtues of a free press. I must study this."
"Very clever, Ivan Nemetovich."
"That's not why I called."
Why is that, Tovarish President? The SVR chairman asked, with sudden concern at the change in his tone.
Ryan was not one to conceal his feelings well.
Sergei, we have a very adverse indication from their Politburo.
I'm faxing it to you now, he heard. I'll stay on the line while you read it.
Golovko wasn't surprised to see the pages arrive on his personal fax machine. He had Ryan's personal numbers, and the Americans had his. It was just one way for an intelligence service to demonstrate its prowess in a harmless way. The first sheets to come across were the English translation of the Chinese ideographs that came through immediately thereafter.
Sergei, I sent you our original feed in case your linguists or psychologists are better than ours, the president said, with an apologetic glance at Dr. Sears. The CIA analyst waved it off.
They have 12 CSS-4 missiles, half aimed at you, half at us. I think we need to do something about those things. They may not be entirely rational the way things are going now.
And your shore bombardment might have pushed them to the edge, Mr. President, the Russian said over the speakerphone. I agree this is a matter of some concern. Why don't you bomb the things with your brilliant bombs from your magical invisible bombers?
Because we're out of bombs, Sergei. They ran out of the sort they need.
Ничего, was the reaction.
You should see it from my side. My people are thinking about a commando-type operation.
I see. Let me consult with some of my people. Give me 20 minutes, Mr. President.
Okay, you know where to reach me.
Ryan punched the kill button on the phone and looked sourly at the tray of coffee things.
One more cup of this shit and I'm going to turn into an urn myself.
The only reason he was alive now, he was sure, was that he'd withdrawn to the command section for 34th Army. His tank division was being roughly handled. One of his battalions had been immolated in the first minute of the battle. Another was now trying to maneuver east, trying to draw the Russians out into a running battle for which his men were trained. The division's artillery had been halved at best by Russian massed fire, and 34th Army's advance was now a thing of the past. His current task was to try and use his two mechanized divisions to establish a base of fire from which he could try to wrest back control of the battle. But every time he tried to move a unit, something happened to it, as though the Russians were reading his mind.
Wah, pull what's left of 302nd back to the 10 o'clock start line and do it now, he ordered.
But Marshal Luo won't. And if he wishes to relieve me, he can, but he isn't here now, is he? Gay snarled back. Give the order.
Yes, Comrade General. With this toy in our hands, the Germans would not have made it as far as Minsk, Bondarenko said.
Yeah, it helps to know what the other guy's doing, doesn't it?
It's like being a god on Mount Olympus. Who thought this thing up?
Oh, a couple of people at Northrop started the idea, with an airplane called Tacit Rainbow. Looked like a cross between a snow shovel and a French baguette. But it was manned, and the endurance wasn't so good.
Whoever it is, I would like to buy him a bottle of good vodka, the Russian general said. This is saving the lives of my soldiers.
And beating the living shit out of the Chinese, Tucker didn't add. But combat was that sort of game, wasn't it?
Do you have any other aircraft up?
Yes, sir. Grace Kelly's back up to cover first armored.
Show me.
Tucker used his mouse to shrink one video window and then opened another. General Diggs had a second terminal up and running, and Tucker just stole its take. There were what looked like two brigades operating, moving north at a measured pace and wrecking every Chinese truck and track they could find. The battlefield, if you could call it that, was a mass of smoke columns from shot-up trucks, reminding Tucker of the vandalized Kuwaiti oil fields of 1991. He zoomed in to see that most of the work was being done by the Bradleys. What targets there were simply were not worthy of a main gun round from the tanks. The Abrams just rode herd on the lighter infantry carriers, doing protective overwatch as they ground mercilessly forward. The Major slaved one camera to his terminal and went scouting around for more action.
Who's this? Tucker asked.
Well, that must be Boyar, Bondarenko said.
It was what looked like 25 T-55 tanks advancing online, and these tanks were using their main guns against trucks and some infantry carriers.
Load heat, Lieutenant Komonov ordered. Target track, 1 o'clock, range 2,000.
I have him, the gunner said a second later.
Fire.
Firing, the gunner said, squeezing the trigger. The old tank rocked backwards from the shot. Gunner and commander watched the tracer arcing out.
Over, damn it, too high. Load another heat.
The loader slammed another round into the breech in a second.
Loaded.
I'll get the bastard this time, the gunner promised, adjusting his sights down a hair. The poor bastard out there didn't even know he'd been shot at the first time.
Fire!
Firing!
Yet another recoil and...
Hit! Good shooting, Vanya!
3 Company was doing well. The time spent in gunnery practice was paying off handsomely, Komonov thought. This was much better than sitting in a damned bunker and waiting for them to come to you.
What is that? Marshal Luo asked.
Comrade Marshal, come here and see, the young lieutenant colonel urged.
What is this?
The defense minister asked with a trailing off voice.
Kauni ma, he breathed.
Then he thundered.
What the hell is this?
Comrade Marshal, this is a website from the Internet. It purports to be a live television program from the battlefield in Siberia.
The young field-grade officer was almost breathless.
It shows the Russians fighting 34th Shock Army.
And?
And they're slaughtering our men, according to this, the lieutenant colonel went on.
Wait a minute. What? How is this possible?
Luo demanded.
Comrade, this heading here says Dark Star. Dark Star is the name of an American unmanned aerial vehicle, a reconnaissance drone, reported to be a stealth aircraft used to collect tactical intelligence. Thus, it appears that they are using this to feed information and putting the information on the Internet as a propaganda tool.
He had to say it that way, and it was, in fact, the way he thought about it.
Tell me more.
The officer was an intelligence specialist.
This explains the success they've had against us, Comrade Marshal. They can see everything we do almost before we do it. It's as though they listen to our command circuit, or even listen into our staff and planning meetings. There is no defense against this, the staff officer concluded.
You young defeatist,
the marshal raged.
Perhaps there is a way to overcome this advantage, but I do not know what it is. Systems like this can see in the dark as well as they can in the sunlight. Do you understand, Comrade Marshal? With this tool, they can see everything we do, see it long before we approach their formations. It eliminates any possibility of surprise. See here, he said, pointing at the screen. One of 34th Army's mechanized divisions is maneuvering east. They are here, he pointed to a printer map on the table. And the enemy is here. If our troops get to this point unseen, then perhaps they can hit the Russians on their left flank. But it will take 2 hours to get there. For the Russians to get one of their units to a blocking position will take but 1 hour. That is the advantage, he concluded.
The Americans do that to us?
Clearly the feed on the Internet is from America, from their CIA.
This is how the Russians have countered us, then?
Clearly, they've outguessed us at every turn today. This must be how they do it.
Why do the Americans put this information out where everyone can see it? Luo wondered. The obvious answer didn't occur to him. Information given out to the public had to be carefully measured and flavored for the peasants and workers to draw the proper conclusions from it.
Comrade, it will be difficult to say on state television that things are going well when this is available to anyone with a computer.
Ah!
Less a sound of satisfaction than one of sudden dread.
Anyone can see this?
Anyone with a computer and a telephone line?
The young lieutenant colonel looked up, only to see Luo's receding form.
I'm surprised he didn't shoot me, the officer observed.
He still might, a full colonel told him. But I think you frightened him. He looked at the wall clock. It was 16 hours, 4 in the afternoon. Well, it is a concern. You young fool, don't you see? Now he can't even conceal the truth from the Politburo. Hello, Yuri, Clark said. It was different to be in Moscow in time of war. The mood of the people on the street was unlike anything he'd ever seen. They were concerned and serious. You didn't go to Russia to see the smiling people any more than you went to England for the coffee. But there was something else, too. Indignation. Anger. Determination? Television coverage of the war was not as strident and defiant as he'd expected. The new Russian news media were trying to be even-handed and professional. There was commentary to the effect that the army's inability to stop the Chinese cold spoke ill of their country's national cohesion. Others lamented the demise of the Soviet Union, whom China would not have dared to threaten, much less attack. Moore asked what the hell was the use of being in NATO if none of the other countries came to the aid of their supposed new ally. We told the television people that if they told anyone of the American division now in Siberia, we'd shoot them. And, of course, they believed us, Lieutenant General Karelin said with a smile. That was something new for Clark and Chavez to see. He hadn't smiled much in the past week. Things looking up? Chavez inquired. Bondarenko has stopped them at the gold mine. They will not even see that, if my information is correct. But there is something else, he added seriously. What's that, Yuri? Clark asked. We are concerned that they might launch their nuclear weapons. Oh, shit, Ding observed. How serious is that? It comes from your president. Golovko is speaking with President Grushevoy right now. And? How do they plan to go about it? Smart bombs? John asked. No. Washington has asked us to go in with a special operations team, Karelin said. What the hell? John gasped. He pulled his satellite phone out of his pocket and looked for the door. Excuse me, General. E.T. phone home. You want to say that again, Ed? Foley heard. You heard me. They've run out of the bombs they need. Evidently it's a pain in the ass to fly bombs to where the bombers are. Fuck, the CIA officer observed, out in the parking lot of this Russian Army Officers Club. The encryption on his phone didn't affect the emotion in his voice. Don't tell me, since Rainbow is a NATO asset, and Russia's part of NATO now, and since you're going to be asking the fucking Russians to front this operation, in the interest of North Atlantic solidarity, we're going to get to go and play too, right? Unless you choose not to, John. I know you can't go yourself. Combat's a kid's game, but you have some good kids working for you. Ed, you expect me to send my people in on something like that, and I stay home and fucking knit socks? Clark demanded heatedly. That's your call to make. You're the Rainbow Commander. How is this supposed to work? You expect us to jump in? Helicopters. Russian helicopters. No thanks, buddy. Our choppers, John. 1st Armored Division had enough, and they're the right kind. They want me to do what? Dick Boyle asked. You heard me. What about fuel? Your fueling point's right about here, Colonel Masterman said, holding the just-downloaded satellite photo. Hilltop west of a place called Chichang. Nobody lives there, and the numbers work out. Yeah, except our flight path takes us within 10 miles of this fighter base. 8 F-111s are going to hit it while you're on the way in. Ought to close down their runways for a good 3 days, they figure. Dick, Dig said, I don't know what the problem is exactly, but Washington is really worried that Joe is going to launch his ICBMs at us at home, and Gus Wallace doesn't have the right bombs to take them out reliably. That means a special ops force, down and dirty. It's a strategic mission, Dick. Can you do it? Colonel Boyle looked at the map, measuring distance in his mind. Yeah, we'll have to mount the outrigger wings on the Blackhawks and load up to the max on gas, but... Yeah, we got the range to get there. Have to refuel on the way back, though. Okay, can you use your other birds to ferry the fuel out? Boyle nodded. Barely. If necessary, the Russians can land a Spetsnaz force anywhere through here with additional fuel, so they tell me. This part of China is essentially unoccupied, according to the maps.
What about opposition on the ground?
There is a security force in the area. We figure maybe 100 people on duty, total, say a squad at each silo. Can you get some Apaches out there to run interference?
Yeah, they can get that far, if they travel light. Just cannon rounds and 2.75-inch rockets, he thought.
Then get me your mission requirements, General Diggs said. It wasn't quite an order. If he said it was impossible, then Diggs couldn't make him do it. But Boyle couldn't let his people go out and do something like this without being there to command them. The Mi-24s finished things off. The Russian doctrine for their attack helicopters wasn't too different from how they used their tanks. Indeed, the Mi-24, called the Hind by NATO, but strangely unnamed by the Russians themselves, was referred to as a flying tank. Using 86 spiral missiles, they finished off a Chinese tank battalion in 20 minutes of jump and shoot, sustaining only 2 losses in the process. The sun was setting now, and what had been 34th Shock Army was wreckage. What few vehicles had survived the day were pulling back, usually with wounded men clinging to their decks. In his command post, General Sinyavsky was all smiles. Vodka was snorted by all. His 265th Motor Rifle Division had halted and thrown back a force more than double its size, suffering fewer than 300 dead in the process. The TV news crews were finally allowed out to where the soldiers were, and he delivered the briefing, paying frequent compliments to his theater commander, Gennady Yosefovich Bondarenko, for his cool head and faith in his subordinates.
He never lost his nerve, Sinyavsky said soberly. And he allowed us to keep ours for when the time came. He is a hero of Russia, the division commander concluded. And so are many of my men.
Thank you for that, Yuri Andreevich, and yes, for that you will get your next star, the theater commander told the television screen. Then he turned to his staff. Andrei Petrovich, what do we do tomorrow?
I think we will let 265 start moving south. We will be the hammer and Diggs will be the anvil. They still have a Type A group army largely intact to the south, the 43rd. We will smash it starting day after tomorrow, but first we will maneuver it into a place of our choosing.
Bondarenko nodded.
Show me a plan, but first I am going to sleep for a few hours.
Yes, Comrade General. Chapter 60 Skyrockets in Flight. It was the same Spetsnaz people they'd trained for the past month or so. Nearly everyone on the transport aircraft was a commissioned officer, doing sergeant's work, which had its good points and its bad ones. The really good thing was that they all spoke passable English. Of the Rainbow Troopers, only Ding Chavez and John Clark spoke conversational Russian. The maps and photos came from SVR and CIA. The latter transmitted to the American Embassy in Moscow and messengered to the military airfield out of which they'd flown. They were in an Aeroflot airliner, fairly full with over 100 passengers, all of them soldiers.
I propose that we divide by nationalities, Kirillin said. Vanya, you and your rainbow men take this one here. My men and I will divide the rest among us using our existing squad structures.
Looks okay, Yuri. One target's pretty much as good as another. When will we be going in?
Just before dawn. Your helicopters must have good range to take us all the way down, then back with only one refueling.
Well, that'll be the safe part of the mission.
Except this fighter base at Anshan, Kirillin said. We pass within 20 kilometers of it.
Air Force is going to hit that, they tell me. Stealth fighters with smart bombs. They're going to post-hole the runways before we drive past.
Ah, that is a fine idea, Kirillin said.
Kind of like that myself, Chavez said.
Well, Mr. C, looks like I get to be a soldier again. It's been a while.
What fun, Clark observed.
Oh, yeah, sitting in the back of a helicopter, going deep into Indian country, where there were sure to be people with guns. Well, could be worse. Going in at dawn, at least the gomers on duty would be partly asleep, unless their boss was a real prick. How tough was discipline in the People's Liberation Army, John wondered. Probably pretty tough. Communist governments didn't encourage backtalk. How exactly are we supposed to disable the missiles? Ding asked. They're fueled by a 10-centimeter pipe, two of them actually, from underground fueling tanks adjacent to the launch silo. First, we destroy the pipes, Kirillin said. Then we look for some way to access the missile silo itself. A simple hand grenade will suffice. These are delicate objects. They will not sustain much damage, the general said confidently. What if the warhead goes off? Ding asked. Kirillin actually laughed at that. They will not, Domingo Stepanovich. These items are very secure in their arming procedures, for all the obvious reasons. And the sites themselves will not be designed to protect against a direct assault. They are designed to protect against nuclear blast, not a squad of engineer soldiers. You can be sure of that.
Hope you're right on that one, fella, Chavez didn't say aloud.
You seem knowledgeable on this subject, Yuri.
Vanya, this mission is one Spetsnaz has practiced more than once. We Russians have thought from time to time about taking these missiles. How you say, take them out of play, yes?
Not a bad idea at all, Yuri.
Not my kind of weapons, Clark said.
He really did prefer to do his killing close enough to see the bastard's face. Old habits died hard, and a telescopic sight was just as good as a knife in that respect. Much better. A rifle bullet didn't make people flop around and make noise the way a knife across the throat did. But death was supposed to be administered one at a time, not whole cities at once. It just wasn't tidy or selective enough. Chavez looked at his Team 2 troopers. They didn't look overtly tense, but good soldiers did their best to hide such feelings. Of their number, only Ettore Falcone wasn't a career soldier, but instead a cop from the Italian Carabinieri, which was about halfway between military and police. Chavez went over to see him.
"How you doing, Big Bird?" Ding asked.
"It is tense, this mission, though," Falcone replied.
"It might be. You never really know until you get there." The Italian shrugged.
"As with raids on mafiosi, sometimes you kick the door and there is nothing but men drinking wine and playing cards. Sometimes they have macchina pistoli, but you must kick the door to find out."
"You do a lot of those?"
"8," Falcone replied. "I am usually the first one through the door because I am usually the best shot. But we have good men on the team there, and we have good men on the team here. It should go well, Domingo."
"I am tense, yes, but I will be all right. You will see," Big Bird ended. Chavez clapped him on the shoulder and went off to see Sergeant Major Price.
"Hey, Eddie.
Do we have a better idea for the mission yet?"
"Getting there. Looks like mainly a job for Paddy, blowing things up."
"Connolly's the best explosives man I've ever seen," Price observed. "But don't tell him that. His head's swollen enough already."
"What about Falcone?"
"Ettore?"
Price shook his head.
"I will be very surprised if he puts a foot wrong. He's a very good man, Ding. Bloody machine. A robot with a pistol. That sort of confidence rarely goes bad. Things are too automatic for him."
"Okay, well, we've picked our target. It's the north and eastmost silo. Looks like it's on fairly flat ground. 2 4-inch pipes running to it. Paddy'll blow those and then try to find a way to pop the cover off the silo or otherwise find an access door. There's one on the overhead. Then get inside, toss a grenade to break the missile, and we get the hell out of Dodge City."
"Usual division of the squad?" Price asked. It had to be, but there was no harm in making sure.
Chavez nodded.
"You take Paddy, Louis, Hank, and Dieter, and your team handles the actual destruction of the missile. I take the rest to do security and overwatch."
Price nodded as Paddy Connolly came over.
"Are we getting chemical gear?"
"What?"
Chavez asked. Ding, if we're going to be playing with bloody liquid-fueled missiles, we need chemical warfare gear. The fuels for these things, you don't want to breathe the vapor, trust me. Red fuming nitric acid, nitrogen tetroxide, hydrazine, that sort of thing. Those are bloody corrosive chemicals they use to power rockets. Not like a pint of bitter at the Green Dragon, I promise you. And if the missiles are fueled and we blow them, well, you don't want to be close, and you definitely don't want to be downwind. The gas cloud will be bloody lethal, like what you chaps use in America to execute murderers, but rather less pleasant. I'll talk to John about that. Chavez made his way back forward. Oh, shit, Ed Foley observed when he took the call. Okay, John, I'll get hold of the Army on that one. How long till you're there?
Hour and a half to the airfield.
You okay?
Yeah, sure, Ed. Never been better.
Foley was struck by the tone. Clark had been CIA's official iceman for close to 20 years. He'd gone out on all manner of field operations without so much as a blink. But being over 50, had it changed him? Or did he just have a better appreciation of his own mortality now? The DCI figured that sort of thing came to everybody.
Okay, I'll get back to you. He switched phones. I need General Moore.
Yes, Director, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said in greeting. What can I do for you?
Our special operations people say they need chemical warfare gear for their mission and...
Way ahead of you, Ed. SOCOM told us the same thing. First Armored's got the right stuff and it'll be waiting for them at the field.
Thanks, Mickey.
How secure are those silos?
The fueling pipes are right in the open. Blowing them up ought not to be a problem. Also, every silo has a metal access door for the maintenance people, and again, getting into it ought not to be a problem. My only concern is the site security force. There may be as much as a whole infantry battalion spread out down there. We're waiting for a KH-11 to overfly the site now for a final check.
Well, Diggs is sending Apaches down to escort the raiding force. That'll be an equalizer, Moore promised. What about the command bunker?
It's centrally located, looks pretty secure, entirely underground, but we have a rough idea of the configuration from penetrating radar.
Foley referred to the KH-14 La Crosse satellite. NASA had once published radar photos that had shown underground tributaries of the Nile that emptied into the Mediterranean Sea at Alexandria. But the capability hadn't been developed for hydrologists. It had also spotted Soviet missile silos that the Russians had thought to be well camouflaged, and other sensitive facilities. And America had wanted to let the Russians know that the locations were not the least bit secret.
Mickey, how do you feel about the mission?
I wish we had enough bombs to do it, General Moore replied honestly.
Yeah, the DCI agreed.
The Politburo meeting had gone past midnight.
So, Marshal Luo, Chion said, things went badly yesterday.
How badly?
We need the truth here, he concluded roughly.
If nothing else, Chion Kun had made his name in the past few days as the only Politburo member with the courage to take on the ruling clique, expressing openly the misgivings that they'd all felt. Depending on who won, it could mean his downfall, either all the way to death or simply to mere obscurity. But it seemed he didn't care. That made him unusual among the men in the room, Fang Gan thought, and it made him a man to be respected. There was a major battle yesterday between 34th Shock Army and the Russians. It appears to have been a draw, and we are now maneuvering to press our advantage, the defense minister told them. They were all suffering from fatigue in the room, and again the finance minister was the only one to rise to his words.
In other words, a battle was fought and we lost it, Chion shot back.
I didn't say that, Luo responded angrily.
But it is the truth, is it not? Chion pressed the point.
I told you the truth, Chion, was the thundering reply.
Comrade Marshal, the finance minister said in a reasonable tone, you must forgive me for my skepticism. You see, much of what you've said in this room has turned out to be less than completely accurate. Now, I do not blame you for this.
Perhaps you have been misinformed by some of your subordinates. All of us are vulnerable to that, are we not? But now is the time for a careful examination of objective realities. I am developing the impression that objective reality may be adverse to the economic and political objectives on whose pursuit this body has sent our country and its people. Therefore, we must now know what the facts are, and what also are the dangers facing us. So, Comrade Marshall, now, what is the military situation in Siberia?
It has changed somewhat, Luo admitted. Not entirely to our benefit, but the situation is by no means lost.
He'd chosen his words a little too carefully. By no means lost, everyone around the table knew, was a delicate way of saying that a disaster had taken place. As in any society, if you knew the aphorisms, you could break the code. Success here was always proclaimed in the most positive terms. Setbacks were brushed aside without admission as something less than a stunning success. Failure was something to be blamed on individuals who'd failed in their duty, often to their great misfortune. But a real policy disaster was invariably explained as a situation that could yet be restored.
"Comrades, we still have our strengths," Zhang told them all. "Of all the great powers of the world, only we have intercontinental missiles, and no one will dare strike us hard while we do."
"Comrade, 2 days ago the Americans totally destroyed bridges so stout that one would have thought that only an angry deity could so much as scratch them. How secure can those missiles be when we face a foe with invisible aircraft and magical weapons?" Chan asked.
"I think we may be approaching the time when Shen might wish to approach America and Russia to propose an end to hostilities," he concluded.
"You mean surrender?" Zhang asked angrily. "Never!"
It had already started, though the Politburo members didn't know it yet. All over China, but especially in Beijing, people owning computers had logged onto the Internet. This was especially true of young people, and university students most of all. The CIA feed, http://www.darkstarfeed.cia.gov/siberiabattle/realtime.ram, had attracted a global audience, catching even the international news organizations by surprise. CNN, Fox, and Europe's Sky News had immediately pirated it, and then called in their expert commentators to explain things to their viewers in the first continuous news coverage of an event since February of 1991. CIA had taken to pirating CNN in turn, and now available on the CIA website were live interviews from Chinese prisoners. They spoke freely, they were so shocked at their fates, stunned at how near they'd come to death, and so buoyantly elated at their equally amazing survival, when so many of their colleagues had been less fortunate. That made for great verbosity, and it was also something that couldn't be faked. Any Chinese citizen could have spotted false propaganda, but equally, any could discern this sort of truth from what he saw and heard. The strange part was that Luo hadn't commented on the Internet phenomenon, thinking it irrelevant to the political facts of life in the PRC. But in that decision he'd made the greatest political misapprehension of his life. They met in college dorm rooms, first of all, amid clouds of cigarette smoke, chattering animatedly among themselves, as students do, and, like students everywhere, they combined idealism with passion.